season of the Molotov seminars. It's a weekly series. We have this talk, these talks almost every Friday at 5 p.m. And these started about 4 years back now. And it's basically a very informal platform for anyone to come and give a talk about anything. And if you want to stay notified of what talks are gonna happen, I think next Friday I'm going to have a friend of mine who works with autistic and schizophrenic patients come and give a talk. She also has a psychology degree, so she'll give like a mixture of the academic plus the actual personal experiential account of treating these patients. And then the next Friday, I don't know yet. But if you want to stay notified of what kinds of talks are gonna happen, you just go here. You can actually like and subscribe Molotov Seminar on Facebook, but I'm not sure you'll necessarily get to know what events are happening. There's just a higher chance that those events will show up on your newsfeed. This is the email list. If you go to this link and sign up for the email subscription, and then if you want to give a talk, I'm always looking for people to give talks. There's a checkbox that says, I want to give a talk. And if you click that checkbox, then I will come and bother you at some point. So that's my little Molotov seminar spiel. And Ian, I think I will leave you to introduce yourself, but I'll just tell you a little bit about how it came to be that Ian and I are here in the same room together. So last semester, there was a special Molotov seminar where that was given by Lynn Ulbricht. Lynn Ulbricht is the mother of Ross Ulbricht. He was an Austin physics graduate, not from UT Austin. And he eventually founded this dark web market called Silk Road. And a lot of things can be found on Silk Road, including drugs. The current Silk Road is not maintained by Ross. It's maintained by someone else. Anyway, the FBI wanted Ross, and they eventually found out. They tracked the IP that was controlling the server, so they jumped him in a San Francisco library, and now he has double life plus 40 years in a maximum security prison. So his mom came and gave a talk, and there were students from SSDP, which is the Students for Sensible Drug Policy, who were there at the talk, and they came and told me, hey, we have some speakers, and so we got started talking, and they put me in touch with Ian. And we couldn't organize his talk last semester because there wasn't enough time left. But here he is, and I thought he would be a great speaker to start off a new season of talks.
Awesome. Thanks, Neil.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. My name is Ian Benweis, and I want to keep this talk really as interactive as possible. I want to share with you, obviously, my background story to put all the specific things in context, but I'm really not interested in hearing myself talk about shit, and I'm going to use the approach that I've been learning in ayahuasca, which you're in ceremony with other people over maybe a 3-day weekend, and when you're talking the next day about your experiences that you're sharing with the group a couple minutes at a time, and it could be up to 40 people, you obviously have been working on your stuff while you're under the medicine and even thinking about it since then. But then when it comes time for you to talk, you're really just supposed to not think about what you're saying and just open up and speak from the heart. And obviously, like a DJ, you've thought about the things that you want to talk about and you've put together and you created, right? But you're not supposed to be like, okay, first I'm going to cover. Because then it's going to take you out of the, out of the moment. So I want to keep it like that as much as possible. So I think most of you have read, obviously, the little background on the description of this event. And so the intersection, really, of these plant medicines and veterans, and then how that kind of fits into the whole, war machine, drug war, pharmaceutical crisis we're having right now. So come on in, man. Just in time. My father's actually a university professor. I grew up mainly in Hawaii. We moved out there in the early 70s. And growing up in Hawaii in the 70s was actually a really awesome place. You could really play outside as a kid. Back when we were kids, you left during the day, and your mom knew that you'd come home when it got dark, and you didn't worry about where you were, or your parents didn't. And cannabis there was really integrated into culture when I grew up there in the 70s, and it was effectively decriminalized, and everybody grew it, and it was part of the culture. It was an island culture. And I remember, you know, my next-door neighbors, who were this Japanese couple across the street in their 60s, we threw a ball or, you know, soccer ball or football, got in their yard, and we went back in there, and they had, you know, two pot plants in their backyard. And I was just like, man, everybody smokes pot. This is like, would have been, you know, late 70s or something. And so I wanted to get the best education I could for the money, which was end up going to West Point to really get a good education and, you know, be able to serve my country and develop some leadership skills and some discipline skills. And went into the Army, where I went to flight school, and I was became a Black Hawk pilot. Right, there's the Apache, which is, you know, a gunship, right, that shoots rockets and hellfires and things like that. And then there's a Black Hawk that you can put people in or equipment, or you can put something underneath it like an artillery piece. And so I graduated from flight school in 1987, was stationed in Fort Ord, California, which is now Cal State Monterey, and just basically south of the Bay Area. And within a couple of months of being at Fort Ord, we got deployed down to Panama in what eventually became, this is in 87, up in 89, the end of 89, Operation Just Cause. So, you know, this is like the drug war that we're fighting all in Central and South America. And so we were down there to eventually just take over to do a regime change on Noriega, Manuel Noriega, who was a U.S. ally, a super good U.S. ally, but eventually kind of went rogue on his own drug empire in Panama, right? So we had to, reel him in. And so that was my experience of that, you know, deployment. It's not like Afghanistan, right, or Iraq, you know. The fighting that went on there, it was much more of a low-intensity drug war, but it was also the actual Operation Just Cause was a chance to use all this special forces equipment, all these Navy SEALs and all these stealth fighters. And so it was the biggest special forces operation in history. So it was like all the cool military stuff, you know, that they wanted to test out. And so I got out of the military, moved to Texas, got a job working for Pfizer. This was the peak of the, this was in 1990. This was the peak of the pharmaceutical industry. And this is just when the SSRIs, like Prozac being the first one, and the synthetic opioids or opiates or whatever you like Vicodin were just really being launched. And there was a lot of promise. And I remember, like, these opiates are not going to addict people. And they're safer than the other ones, right? They're more powerful, more effective, and less addictive. And it's like, that's happened for every single thing. I mean, heroin was sold as a, is basically a way to deal with being addicted to opium. That's how it was marketed. So you just have a continuation of that. But in any case, so I did see some of the goods that some of the drugs did. We sold these heart medications and blood pressure medications. But hey there, you saw a lot how much hype and possibility that they put on these SSRIs. And so from there, I went to law school. And basically in law school, I got started on my spiritual path. Let's see. I went to Panama. Almost drowned body surfing off Santa Cruz. This ex-military guy who had mental health issues robbed my house while I wasn't there, burned it down. Went and got mental health treatment, fit enough to stand trial, and then he killed himself the night before he was supposed to come and be in that trial. So, and then I moved to Texas, and my first wife left me. So I was like, oh, wow, the universe is trying to get my attention. And so that was like for me the beginning of my spiritual path, which as it turned out for myself, was like, you know, immersing myself in the writings and scriptures of these traditions that I was going to look at the textbooks, you know, myself, and at the same time, these plant medicines. And, you know, in Hawaii, the kind of that matrix of being there in nature certainly supported that with the cannabis. And then, you know, like mushrooms grew all around my high school, like in the cow patties where the cows were. And so I started putting those two things together for myself. And I was basically starting to heal myself from traumas that I didn't realize I had. I didn't realize there was such a thing called trauma. I didn't realize that bad things happened to anyone other, you know, I only thought bad things happened to other people. And so I started working on myself, fixing myself so I could, and I got remarried, be a good husband and raise a family. But I didn't understand trauma or any of that kind of stuff. So I still dove into that. And that's, you know, I've MDMA and LSD and mescaline and mushrooms and ayahuasca and DMT and 5-MeO-DMT. And this was the age of the internet coming online, right? Early 90s. Yeah. And the psychonautic revolution, where if you had an internet connection and you had a credit card, you could surf the internet, right, find information on things and potentially buy them and have them sent to your house, and then be able to confer with other people online as to what everybody was doing. But I did a ton of work back then, and even got to sit with the ayahuasca shaman here in Austin, like back in maybe around 98. It was like the first guy to come up from Peru, you know, and come to the U.S. and do that kind of stuff. And so then I graduated from law school, focused on IP, did the whole corporate world thing for a long time in big companies and startups, a lot of high-tech startups. And but then about 4 years ago, I met veterans. And I went to this normal conference on veterans, the first one in Texas. And it's designed to start getting veterans together, and this whole political issue, right, of getting Canada's freedom to help veterans. And anyway, I met these veterans telling their stories, which none of them were a surprise to me, the stories themselves, PTSD and getting blown up with IEDs and TBI, traumatic brain injury, and coming back and being on the medications and drinking and suicide and suicidal ideation. I mean, I knew about those things, but hearing their stories, I was like crying and I was like purging while I'm hearing their stories, you know? And I was like, what's going on here? And I realized, wow, I have a lot of work to do still here. This is my second round of healing, and I knew about these medicines, and so it was a totally natural thing for me to go right back into them and continue to do my work. And in that interim time between, you know, when I first started with the medicines and raising a family, I had a daily spiritual practice, which I've maintained the whole time, you know, and learned to do meditation and doing yoga now for, you know, over like 8 years or something. And so I had this excellent reintegration machine and container and platform to be able to do a lot of work in a shorter amount of time at an older age, you know, in my life. And then basically, like, did ayahuasca like 54 times in the past 3 years, which is a lot. But, you know, that's in about the mid-40s of that. That's when I, like, accepted myself. I processed sexual traumas from, like, second and third grade. And my sister dying when I was 4 months old. And, you know, everything, all of it. So that's how long it took. So in that intersection of me doing my personal work, and, of course, more interest coming out about this in society, I started then to intersect with veterans again. And after that initial meeting, and of course I knew, like, well, I got to continue to work on myself. These plant medicines can help do that. I'm a veteran, and I hadn't been integrated with other veterans. And so those two things just came together, and I started basically connecting with other veterans who were trying to do the same thing. And so started to do that with other veterans, and realized as that process went on that veterans were going to be the ones ultimately to be the avatars or the exemplars of how to end the drug war and show society, the planet, culture that you can't solve your political problems anymore using the military, like, you know, fighting conventional wars. It doesn't work anymore. So now I'm involved with, gosh, what do? I support taking lots of people to go do these medicines, ayahuasca and the 5-MeO-DMT and the toad. Done that in Mexico and in Peru and then other places. And so, yeah, that's a lot about me. So, yeah, so let's start with some questions right there, because I could start talking about doing these medicines and experiences and whatever, but, you know. Okay. Then I'll get you next.
Right, okay. On. If you had to have some statistics on how many people have you taken to either Mexico or here to do these medicines, and how many of them have recovered or are on the path to recovery?
I've been in this, taking people and been involved with healing stuff with, I don't know, maybe getting near 100 people over the past couple years. And, you know, it's all over the place, because ultimately the highest correlator to acquiring PTSD in war is childhood trauma. Think of it like an infectious disease, something that you get exposed to and you acquire. If you have a good childhood and you go there and you do this stuff and you come back and you have a good support system, you have a better chance of reintegrating versus someone who's already messed up. So you have this childhood trauma really problem underneath. And so these things aren't any kind of silver bullets. So I'm going to say this, the rates are much better than any of the conventional means, and I think that's really the ultimate measure. They're sustainable. They you don't have to give them for forever. You know, they're not like maintenance drugs. So, but I'm just saying, I know friends that are just, they're still deep in doing their work. So really, it remains to be seen if they can pull it out. But the people that I'm working with that are like, you know, close to me and connected to me are doing incredible and doing awesome. I just don't want to, though, you know, paint some kind of like unrealistic picture. But, so, and sorry. So you had a question.
So what is it? Well, you don't just do the drugs. You talk or stuff. I guess that's not really a question.
That's okay. Go for it.
What is the process if when you go and do the like ayahuasca?
Yeah.
You said there was a shaman, so he facilitates in some way.
Yes. So it's in a ceremonial space. Let's pretend this room is an ayahuasca ceremony. There's some sort of altar, which is just to, you know, put it in a sacred space and have an orientation. And that person is then using music to be the, like, mandala or metronome or, you know, like, focus point for the sort of meditation, group meditation that everyone's doing while they're on the medicine. And the medicine's a psychic magnifier. So if you have things in your unconscious that need to be addressed, it directs the focus of that medicine on those things. And so you have music, and then you have periods of silence. So the music sometimes helps to give it focus, and then there's other times where it's more quiet, meditative, and the whole medicine itself is the whole time coming in waves, and there's moments where you're like, have moments of complete lucidity, and you're totally sober, and then, you know, seconds later, you're like, oh my God, I'm never going to make it. I'm, you know, tripping balls so hard and I can't, and I don't know, you know, what's what. And so, but the shaman or facilitator practitioner is holding the energetic space for the room, right? Keeping just the, however you want to think about it, you know, distractions, negative energy, you know, at bay, and keeping the integrity of the energetic room together. And then, you know, supporting people individually if they need it, or giving people individual attention or analysis, you know, depending on their particular approach. And in Peru, and Carlos and his work and his brothers, you come to them and they, and he sings you. Like in the case we went down there, we had the three brothers. It was super special. We had, you know, you figure there's 10,000 Shipibo that are existing. Half of those are practicing. 10% of the shamans are legit. That's the number that everybody agrees upon in all of, you know, Central and South America. So it's like 500 people. We had three brothers that were like third generation, two, you know, mom and grandmother before. And so you would go up and one of those guys would sing you a song. And that song is like, you know, it's a healing song. It's that person's looking at your energy and, you know, helping to direct the medicine inside you and support your work with it. And yeah, so basically that person is giving you some specialized attention. Yeah, so you're just sitting there on your mat for 6 to 8 hours while the music goes in and out and you ride the waves of the experience. So
I was just wondering like how you were feeling and what led you to have these like first spiritual experiences, you said?
First spiritual experiences, what?
I guess you said that you had that first phase.
Oh, like, yeah. What prompted me to... Yeah. Well, it was these life or death things. I almost drowned and, you know, my house burned down and it was just weird circumstances. The guy burned it down was just, you know, had mental health issues and my wife left me. So that was like, spiritual crisis, spiritual emergency. Yeah. Well, you know, why am I here? What am I doing? And that... And, you know, why plants, you know, that part is, if that's maybe your question, I'm not sure other than I can say, like I was alluding to, that growing up in Hawaii and that culture where you were in nature, you know, and you seem connected to it, that seemed like a natural approach. But it wasn't something like where, you know, something popped out of the sky and said, dude, you should do, you know, this. And I was like, oh, that's the answer. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers it or not, but... Yeah.
How would you compare ayahuasca to the other medicines you've done for people that haven't experienced it through the actual experience?
So it's these medicines are a mirror, just like mindfulness techniques. Think about yoga or meditation or flotation tanks or light therapy or anything. They're tools to allow for self introspection. And of course, not just at your higher level mental functions, but all of your subconscious and stuff where all the really important deep stuff is going on. And it just allows you, and it also drives you, and this is crazy kind of dance with it, where you can see those things, but your ego's down-regulated, but not off, and your judgment is, you know, kind of turned off. It's just down regulating law through ego, and then your fear response is turned off. And then, you know, they're mapping this stuff scientifically right in the brain, the amygdala. And all. But so you can then see, you can go back and revisit something in your life that was an experience that has, it's traumatic, it's still stored in you, and have some kind of different, greater perspective on it that you can then recontextualize it and go, oh, okay, now that I see that. I can accept that more. That makes more sense. So basically, a psychic magnifier that's going to look in you, and you already know what it's looking for because the things that you're hiding, and help bring that psychic material out in a way that you can evaluate it and literally reintegrate it back into you. It's really got to dismember yourself, right, before you can remember yourself, before you can shamanically remember yourself. And that whole idea and those concept, right, is that you take yourself, you die a certain death, and you cut yourself up, and then you rebuild all the parts in the nice and new, and then you put it all back together in your new body. But that's a great still metaphor for, you can look at that from the psychological aspect of, you know, going through your subconscious stuff and processing it and integrating it back into you. But as far as the experience, you know, the culture is kind of programmed with the Terrence McKenna, you know, self-transforming machine elves and the, you know, I was ready for the alien vistas and the, you know, alien Disneyland, and I was like, wow, where's all the visual stuff when I first took it? And it was like super heart-centered, and I was taking out the Jedi holocrons for each person in my life for like a half hour, an hour, and just sitting there and be like, wow, and just like looking back at all what that person means in my life. And there was, you know, no visuals. And I think the more you do it, there's less visuals. Visuals are the sort of like an attractor and sort of letting you know that the medicine's there and working. But ultimately, you don't need to have any visuals at all with the experience. So it's very personalized. It's very custom. Somehow the medicine, while you're in a group of people, if people know what they're doing and all that, you know, where every person, where they're at in their own life, and all these people all together somehow can come together, and everyone can get what they need at the same time, which is why it's done and recommended to be done, you know, in group settings with some with a qualified practitioner, because doing things like that off on your own, if you're not, if you don't have the skills or the practice, you can get yourself into some tough spots. Does that answer your question enough? Or
yeah, I guess I was also curious how you feel like ayahuasca differs from other medicines you've done in terms of like just the way it affects people or the perspective you get.
Well, like maybe what would be some other medicines that you were wanting to compare it to?
Like maybe, you know, mushrooms or MDMA.
Sure. So, right, DMT is Schedule I drug made by your pineal gland, made by your lungs as well. And you basically, you have DMT and then you have a hydroxyl group on it. That makes psilocin, which is the active ingredient, right, in magic mushrooms when you take off the phosphoryl group and, you know, off the psilocybin. And so these things are all very similar. These things are all very close to the, you know, serotonin and other neurotransmitters that are in your brain. So ayahuasca is unique because the DMT normally gets deactivated in your gut by monoamine oxidase, an enzyme. The ayahuasca vine, the MAOI in there, blocks that. And so you have effects from the MAOI separate from its orally activating the DMT. That's different than other medicines. So if you took mushrooms, you're getting like a variant on that DMT, and it does certain things. And then when you take ayahuasca, you're getting the DMT, and you're getting these beta carbolines, which, you know, a lot of people will describe ayahuasca like, you know, getting your hard drive defragged, or getting scrubbed at the atomic or molecular or cellular level. Concepts like that. So ultimately, I mean, there's no difference. You know what I mean? There's at the deepest level, there's no difference between mushrooms or DMT or 5-MeO-DMT if you go far enough. You know, so I've written some stuff that I talk about the difference in subtleties, but that's probably way, you know, way too deep for this here. They just, you know, fit. They have different affinities, right, for these different receptor and subreceptor types in the brain, 5-HT1A and 2 and 2C and all these. And so they all have these subtle differences, but ultimately they're psychic magnifiers that are mirrors that help people to see inside themselves and use whatever they experience as the metaphor or vision or piece of art that they can take back from the experience and go, oh, when I was had all these thoughts, I remember seeing this thing, right? And that thing, now I can go back and think about it later. That vision I had is a way to think back on the problem I was solving or the, you know, understanding that I got. So
you said that these things, unlike conventional medications, aren't something you need a prescription for. They just last definitely.
Well, that you wouldn't have to take them like as a maintenance drug, where these other
So that was the question. You also said you've taken ayahuasca, I think, like 50 times in the last few years. So do you get something different out of each experience, or is it just kind of like, I don't know, charging up again, or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. I haven't gotten to a point where I'm like, yeah, I definitely need to stop. And so I've also, number one, that there's never an end to the layers of the onion. That's really the truth. There are definitely people that I've met that are just chasing the medicines, and they're like shaking the snow globe, but they don't wait long enough for the snow to settle back down before they shake it again. And so they're just in complete festival mode all the time, just fucking shaking the snow globe and chasing the next adventure, never doing that. So, you know, for me, like I said, it took into 40s of ceremonies before I fully accepted myself. And I said, I'm happy for every single thing that happened to me, and not like with any kind of holding out or regrets or trading or rationality. Just like, yes, all those things that I otherwise might have thought of bad, now I accept the greater logic, the greater love, you know, for those things happening. And now I've spent more time going to either deeper levels or, let's say, after sexual trauma. Now you're like, okay, now that you've accepted that, integrated, you still have to figure out what that means at this point. And so I'm also, you know, taking other people with me as well, right? So I'm now in a mode more where it's like going to AA or something also. And I'm still doing there, able to do my work, and I'm not wasting my time or twiddling my fingers, but supporting other people, whether they be veterans or not, you know, going and doing their work. So it's really, like I said, totally personal. I met this woman, she's done it 100 times, and it's like, you know, I'm not trying to judge her, right? But if someone's asking me, like, yeah, well, doesn't seem like it's helping her a lot, and there might be someone who's done it 3 times, and that's all they ever need, you know. So,
yeah. Is there any like cue or anything?
No, I was gonna get. I'll just point out. Get him. Go ahead.
Oh, me.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any cue that causes you to, you know, take another dose?
There's any what?
Is
cue.
There any cue, like something like you feel.
Oh, like you're in ceremony and you're gonna take more? Is that?
Oh no. Like.
Oh, like before, do it again.
Like when you start a ceremony, it's like their reason you say, okay, I'm gonna start the ceremony.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
So your decision to go back and do it again, like do you think to yourself, oh, I need another one now because I've processed the previous stuff, or what is it that makes you decide, okay, time for another one?
Well, in this, like, you know, 3 years, it's just been continuous where I never thought, oh, I don't need to go do this again. I'm, you know, let's see. Yeah, I don't know that there's any cue or anything. I basically set out to do this work on myself and to go all the way and to finish. So that's like months, you know what I'm saying, where I'm and there's no finishing. So it's just more that I've accepted myself and now trying to figure out what that means as far as who I am. But I'm, like I said, I'm still taking other people to go do it. So, yeah, I don't know. Oh, wait, so you're back there, yeah.
So drug use is kind of a big part of Western culture as well, American culture, but it's not really ritualized in the same way you're describing. Like, there's these complex code rituals around the procedure. I'm curious about what, based on your experience, what role does it play in the cultures in which it's done like that? Seems like it's more of a normal sort of progression that somebody would find themselves in. How does that work?
Number one, right, this is, in tribal societies, what we did. We got together once a week around the fire and we sang songs and we drank whatever our traditional medicine was, whatever kind of medicine it was, and worked out our stuff, and then everybody went back to their hammocks and their huts or whatever, and, you know, went back to business. And so, yeah, that sort of ceremonial aspect has been lost right into Western culture with these medicines and so many other things, right? There's no, you know, we don't have rites of passage. So we've lost not just around the medicine, but all these different ceremonial things. And what the container does is very important because it creates a safe place for people to do this work. And you can't go deep if you're worried for your safety when you're taking these. And, you know, this is a big challenge with the ayahuasca tourism that's going on in, you know, Peru especially, where people are going down there and getting, you know, taken advantage of. And there's just people being thrown together, people that shouldn't be there. And so having the safe container, having the ritual, just kind of focuses on the importance of what the thing you're trying to do there, bringing everyone together in a common exercise of group healing. And it accelerates the process. It creates a deeper floor of safety and vulnerability where people can express more and like I said, be safer. So And it provides a kind of closure too, for it's like, okay, now we're done with ceremony, and you got to go back and into life and reintegrate it. So yeah, just really protects the work, increases the depth and power of it, and yeah, just makes it a lot safer. So.
Can I just have one?
Yeah, yeah, please, man.
One follow up. So, in those tribal societies,
yeah.
who would participate in these rituals?
Is in the tribal society, everybody, including
it's open to everybody.
Everybody, including kids, man. In these societies, you know, yeah, kids, you know, they get them early, and here's a little taste of peyote, or here's a little taste of ayahuasca, and just that it's something that's integrated. You know, and there are cultures that they don't feel like they've stepped outside of the circle of nature, where we kind of, you know, can have that in the West, right, where we're see ourselves as something separate from that. And I remember doing DMT, I mean, you know, ayahuasca, like 3 years ago, and it was just coming on so strong. I hadn't done it in 18 years, and I was like, oh my God, I'm just going to get my ass kicked. And then I was like, this is nature. This is DMT. This isn't something outside. This isn't alien. This is already in me. So what is it that I'm trying to fight against? Where do I draw the line between nature's DMT and my DMT? It's like, it's ridiculous. There's no boundary. So, yeah, and you know, and I'm a self-confessed, professed psychonaut, you know, and I totally believe in, you know, free will and personal freedom, personal responsibility, and so I'm not one of those people that believes that you only have to do that in, you know, what I'm saying, with a shaman in a ceremony, but that's just like a tried and true way, and that doesn't prevent anyone here from using those same techniques as well, and that's, you know, obviously happening, so. Yeah.
Can I add?
Sure.
Because
sure.
Question about this ceremonial aspect. So I'm totally skeptical about the shaman and ceremonial aspect. And I went to Peru and did this for 10 days. And at first I was like, what? This is just like these are like setting intentions and stuff like that. But to me, now looking back at it, it's clear that how, because the drug is an amplifier of your subconscious, so having that space, there is set an intention, and that sort of prepares those emotions to rise up and be amplified. And then as he was mentioning, they're not talking, shamans during the ceremony are not giving any specific instructions. They're just singing songs or even like coming close to you and just doing. And I was like, okay, does this? But now it seems like the minds don't have memories and not stored in like a chronological order, right? There are triggers that can trigger different things and then you make them pop up. And these tongues and the smell of, like, they'll have some smell, like a smoke, they'll have their smoke on you, they'll be doing it. All these just like trigger different memories that might be stored deep down that you don't even remember them and bring them up. And for me, each song started a new episode of exploring, and then as the song ended, that episode ended. And then again, a different song started and again an episode started. And I was like, man, I would have never thought all this
woo woo, yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, what he said. Yeah. So, sure.
I like the idea of talking about how you prep for ceremony. You had brought up the prepping for ceremony, and then you had asked how do you know when you're ready to do medicine again. I'm curious how you help people prep.
Sure. Well, it's really understand that they have a support network of people that they can talk to after the process that have experience with the medicine, who can first obviously tell them, no, you're not nuts. It's totally normal to be experiencing all these things. And that they can, you know, it can be professional, it can be friendship, you know, but just some form of being able to have someone else that they can get counsel with, that they can share. And So, and then really it's the, you know, does this person have the spiritual, the, you know, emotional, the physiological integrity to be able to take the medicine and then do the work? Because everybody says they want to take the red pill, but then they take the red pill and they're like, man, this really sucks. I didn't want this much truth in reality, and I want to go back to eating the fake steak, even though I know it's fake. And so that's, you know, so you really, you know, you're not trying to overhype the experience part of it as much as, listen, this is whatever it's going to happen to you, it's going to be this amplifier, it's going to magnify these things, and you're going to get understanding, but it's going to be then to do work from that. Now that you've learned that, what are you going to do with that? And so if you're not prepared to do the work, so I think that, you know, understanding, hey, what kind of, you know, spiritual, meditative, mindfulness, whatever words you want to use, practice do you have to have some just time to sit there when you're not being distracted by other people or work or electronics or anything, you know, to meditate, reflect, process that stuff. And then I think, you know, it is important for people to have some sort of spiritual philosophy, outlook, understanding, whatever. It's not anybody believing anything. It's just like, but you have to have some sort of outlook, because if you just go in and get yourself totally ripped up and opened up here, you'll just freaking believe anything. And then there's people that are like that, and they just get totally opened up and they believe everything. And, you know, that's just as bad as believing nothing, right? So having some sort of, you know, outlook that you can put these bigger experiences, bigger cosmic downloads into. So, yeah, the really having the, you know, what I do is ask people, it's really easy. I just say, what's the reason that you're called to the medicine? And usually they just, you know, volunteer all the key stuff, which, as you can see, is like, are they chasing it? Are they trying to avoid something? Do they really? And then it's usually, most of the time, it's like, I've got these serious freaking problems, serious demons. I'm going to die if I don't solve them, and I need help doing them. And yeah, but just having the support network, having people you can, you know, just understand what you've done, not just, in other words, the person who can talk to you, but someone who can has the intersection of talk to you and experience of these medicines, and then the, you know, spiritual practice, discipline, the ability to have time away from other people, the ability to control your diet and everything that you eat. You know, if you're in an environment where you're surrounded by a lot of distractions, and from that, it's going to be more challenging as well. So, yeah.
So, is one of the side effects of like ayahuasca when you take it, like some people will feel extremely nauseous or very ill, and that it would take some, like, either some preparation or a low dose for them to, well, like, to get, like, for their bodies to accept this medicine?
The main reason for if people feel ill or bad on ayahuasca would be that they haven't follow the dietary restrictions on the way in, or another way of saying, they just make really poor lifestyle choices, and they eat crap. You know, if you eat crap and you don't clean yourself up before you do ayahuasca, the medicine will kick your ass, and it will not be fun, and it will suck, because the medicine will tell you what you already know is that eating, you know, a bunch of soda and processed foods and you know, all the bad stuff that we eat is not good for you. So there, something totally separate is purging, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
kind of like the visions with ayahuasca, vomiting, as it's more looked at, right, is this thing that's seen with ayahuasca. It's just ignore that. Basically, when you take ayahuasca, you expose the subconscious material and you purge, which is you can purge by pooping, peeing, sweating, laughing, crying, singing, ejecting stuff out of your stomach. But it's not like vomiting from, like, you know, if you had the flu or you got sick drinking or something. It's energetic expulsion of that stuff in there So you're both energetically letting go and your body's physically letting go. And, you know, you get that sort of spirit and matter experience marry together, and it just super intensifies it. And just kind of like when you sneeze or other bodily functions where it takes over your whole body, when you're purging, you can't do or think about anything else. And so it's super, you know, has super psychological power when you do that. You really, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh my God, I want to let go of this shit. And you're like, bleh, you're literally letting go. And if you can't be telling your body anymore that you're letting go. So ayahuasca doesn't make you ill at all in and of itself. And if you do purge, you might feel nauseous on the part of leading up to the purge. But I can say from repeated experiences, you feel like $1 million when you purge because you're literally letting go. So you don't feel after. It's like, you know, you're like you're sick in your stomach, and then you're like, oh, this really sucks. Now you're like, oh my God, I survived that. Oh wow, I feel great now. So, does that kind of answer it? Or?
Yeah, and also ibogaine, has it, for people who have taken that, have there been like improvements in like addiction to certain drugs such as like cocaine or alcohol and stuff like that?
Ibogaine is really amazing. I've taken it myself. I volunteered to be like a vet guinea pig. Right, 2 weeks before I went to, a week before I went to Peru, I did ibogaine and the toad. And then 2 weeks before that, I did 3 days of ayahuasca. And the ibogaine crossroads, the place that I went, you know, and paid for all my stuff. And I did brain scans before and after. They had like 75% success rates for meth and coke and heroin and other opiates at about a year out with ibogaine. And of course, I mean, that's just incredible. Nothing else can touch that. And the ibogaine, it works on trauma, it works on traumatic brain injury, and it works on addiction. And of course, addiction is the thing that people see the biggest sort of focus on. And what it does is it like gives you like this biochemical reset where you come out and you don't have the cravings part, because you can go and see the trauma, accept it, understand it, whatever, forgive yourself. And then you're addressing the psychological reason why you were self-medicating with whatever these drugs were, right? You don't need them anymore, but you still have your brain hardwired for that addiction, right? And the ibogaine just like, you know, unplugs all this stuff. The best way I can describe the ibogaine is that it's like the, you know, operator you have there that's making all the connections. It's all unplugged. So you're sitting there after ibogaine, you have some kind of trigger that would otherwise you'd run some program, right? You're like, oh, wow, normally I'd run this program. Wow, I don't have to run that program. I can run that program. I can run a different program. I can edit that program. I can add subroutines. You know what I mean? You start realizing, because so much of our behavior is, you know, on autopilot, right, where we just response and trigger. And so it really unhooks all that and then gives you that chance not only so you've got the biochemical reset, you've understood more about your life story stuff around the trauma, and now you're like, oh, okay, cool. What do I want to do? So, and it for me, I didn't have addictions, but it'll work in the level of compulsions, you know, obsessions, whatever. And trauma, especially early childhood trauma, pre-verbal trauma, you blame yourself because you don't have the logic developed over on this side to make any kind of rational sense of it. And so, yeah, ibogaine through these brain scans showed I had excess electrical activity across my entire left frontal lobe across all frequencies. I was overclocking my chip, and it was running hotter. And then so I could still process, but sometimes it would just, you know, not work. And the way they, like, explain when you look at those brain scans, they say that my ability to have like flexibility of thought was more limited. Not like I could process one thing and do that, but I couldn't easily switch around. And so after the ibogaine, I got a better balancing of my hemispheres, and it actually, they've shown that it helps to develop the connections through the corpus callosum, right, which we know in women is by default more connected than in men. And so, yeah, I got all this personal healing where you go from like maybe the hardware science of overclocking my chip to a more reasonable speed was that I could have more flexibility of thought, and my mom has, you know, had mania her whole life, and definitely I got, you know, got some of the genetics from that. It kind of brought down some of the, I didn't really have any kind of, it's not like bipolar, right, in the depressive part, but just, it just kind of brought some mania a little bit more in check. So, and that, the fact that that medicine is not used with the opiate crisis is just, it's just horrible. It's unbelievable. There's only 6 countries in the world where it's illegal. We're one of them. But if you can drive down to Mexico or go 12 miles offshore in international waters. So,
okay, so this is a question in terms of trauma healing through ayahuasca.
Yeah.
I have like 2 questions. I'm curious, when somebody is like doing a ceremony in hopes of like helping heal trauma, after this, I know integration is a really important thing, and you're welcome to explain integration to everybody else because they may not know. But I'm curious, like after the ceremony, is there confusion about what they just went through, or do they kind of immediately know what they just went through, and they're like super open to like their traumas that have surfaced? And what do you think that the what's like a general time of where like integration starts taking place after ceremonies, or does it take multiple ceremonies for like integration to start taking place?
The medicine starts to work the time when you choose, like you're asking about the cue, whatever, to do those ceremonies. So it starts to work because you create the intention, and the intention creates the focus in your mind, and so you start to prepare for it. And then, so let's say someone did some processing of some trauma in ceremony. There could be the opportunity after the ceremony's over, like lots of ceremonies, when you're done, then you go and eat because you haven't really been eating during the day while you're doing it. And so there could be an opportunity there to talk to the shaman, you know, and say, hey, here's what I experienced, and can you give me some insight into that or some help around or something. What normally happens a lot is that people sit down with their food, and then people just start sharing and start using the kind of people being mirrors to each other, right, of saying, yeah, wow, it was just, you know, this thing and whatever, and then that's like, it's still a safe space. So the reintegration kind of begins in that social environment right after, and kind of like a meditation retreat or something, you're sort of out there doing that and not doing other stuff. And so there's plenty of time where people are sitting around, you know, and sharing and talking and meditating by themselves. So it's happening while you're out there over this 3 or 4 or 5 day weekend already, right after ceremony's over. And I'm sorry, on your second question, it was like, say it again?
I was wondering, because I know for a lot of people, sometimes the integration doesn't immediately happen. There's still a lot of processing what happened. What do you think is like the general time when it begins to start happening?
Like I said, I think it really starts after that first ceremony is over. You start to put together some of those things that you just opened up, and then you go back in for another dive, you know what I mean? And so it might be the same thing, or it might be something different. And every day is part of the process, either right after for a short amount of time, or the next day. The next day you could be spending 2 to 3 hours in a group of 40 people where people are going around one person at a time, which is an exercise, right? We're not normally able to do or normally do, where that person's like, okay, my name's Ian, and yeah, last night, here's, you know, what I, you know, what came up for me, and you're sharing out with the group. But also it's like, not just to be like, hey, let me tell you the cool stuff I experienced, but let me be very vulnerable, right? So the reintegration's happening there, where I'm like, yeah, and all the things that I'm told you about, or I've shared, or that I've shared publicly, of course I've shared first in ayahuasca ceremony, you know, hey, I just resolved the sexual trauma, and you're like telling somebody your personal experience. So it's happening right there. And then you're getting healing from other people's being there and listening to your story and letting go of it another way by telling it. And then someone else tells the story, and you're like, wow, that person's just like me. Or I see that aspect of what happened to them, how it helps me to see something. So this whole thing of just like mirrors and mirrors and mirrors. And then you're just like, wow, you know, you're getting healing from, I'm the only person that's messed up, or, you know what I mean, the only one that's got problems, or whatever, you know, whatever your ego's telling you inside your own experience. The validation you get by people coming together and vulnerability and sharing this stuff is super healing, and is another form of reintegration. So, and then after that, you know, people will have get-togethers, reintegration potlucks, people will be in their smaller groups of people getting together on a regular basis. When we came back from Peru, we're all over the country, right? So we set up, when we went down there, I created this Facebook chat for all the people that were going. It was this crazy, like, logistics, therapy group, all this kind of crazy stuff. And then we came back. We did, like, Skype calls twice a week, Monday and Friday. It started off, and they were, like, 4 hours long. And this was just six of us, you know? And because it was that crazy. And then we went, and I took those same veterans back to Mexico for Ibogaine, a bunch of them in totes. So, yeah, you got to, you know, build that process. But it starts happening right away, and it can continue on, you know, for days, weeks, months, a lifetime. And that's really the truth is that, you know, if you start on this, you should just be aware that the only way is through, and, you know, you just don't want to, like, remodel your house or your life halfway. You know, so.
And also, when the first time that trauma pops up, it might not be as specific as, oh, I was abused in my childhood. It might be something that makes you really afraid, and you're like, I don't want to enter this space that is making me afraid. Or it might be like a demon or a thing that symbolizes that fear of entering that space. And then so the next day you talk about it, and maybe on your own or by this talking and hearing, you're like, okay, I can enter that space. And then you do it in the next ceremony, you reach there and you're like, okay, I'm ready to enter the space. And you're then able to make the progress to seeing things that are driving you, accepting them, being okay with them. And so, yeah, it also, yeah, it all depends on how much, like, this, like, how much effort you put in and how much acceptance you
do
that. Yeah.
I'm comparing it to, like, MDMA treatment with PTSD. Like, MDMA obviously, like, works through, like, the amygdala and through the brain, but this sounds like a lot of, like, self-work and, like, work that you're doing, dying, like, you are becoming more aware of the ego and working through that and, like, using other people to help you as, like you said, as, like, mirrors. So
yeah.
That's just, like, really cool. I'm thinking about the two types of therapies. And
yeah, I think you can really get to the same kind of places ultimately with all, you know, with all these different medicines, more therapeutic sessions, environments, more shamanic environments, you know, whatever. It's just really more that you create a safe space where you can do the work. So, yeah.
So do you have to leave the country every time you do this?
No. I really like that question. So, yeah, so kind of the earlier question about, you know, the legality. That's the big challenge, right, is that every single resident in the United States is guilty of possessing at least two Schedule I substances, DMT and 5-MeO. DMT made at least by your pineal gland and 5-MeO by your retina and DMT by your lungs, and I'm sure they'll find it in other places, you know. It's hard to measure because it gets broken down so fast. So so you have the schedule, and you have, you know, people heard of these Native American churches where they drink, you know, eat peyote, right? You have jurisprudence as well where there's two churches that are from Brazil, two syncretic Christian with a little bit of sometimes African religion in there mixed with the ayahuasca, the Santo Daime and the UDV, where you can't ever say sort of like this is legal or this is illegal until it's sort of tested, right? You know, I can sit here and be like, hey, everything that I'm doing is protected under the First Amendment. But there may be someone else, like, who works at the DA, right? You know, who might have a completely different view on it. So those two churches, though, have Supreme Court jurisprudence, right? You know, saying that they are allowed, that they're protected under the First Amendment. But yet, and there's a number of Santo Daime churches in the U.S., number of individual chapters, and same thing with the UDV, but only a couple of them have filed for their DEA exemption, which would allow them to bring medicine across the border, you know, into the U.S. and everybody else is doing it underground. So there's like, so both, you know, Santo Daime Church that's filed for the DEA exemption and got it, and the one that hasn't, they're both equally legitimate, right? But one has chosen to kind of make a public disclosure with the government to get protection to be able to do something, but they're also sort of then saying, hey, here's who we are, here's our address, we have medicine here, you know, and I don't know, do you want to come and inspect our medicine and see how much we have and see what we're doing? This, you know, so there's a trade-off, and because of that, the majority of churches that are practicing that are doing it underground. And but I feel, I'll jump into my, you know, political advocacy hat, and I kind of alluded to at the beginning with the presidential election in 2020. You got the opiate crisis, you got the mental health crisis, suicide crisis. I think the scheduling artifice is the, you know, Controlled Substance Analog Act, which puts all these drugs, including cannabis, Schedule 1 and other, you know, schedule numbers, is going to come down. Because if you can pull cannabis off of it, if you can pull psilocybin or MDMA, which are on track right now to be FDA-approved drugs, 2020, 2021. Once you get one off, I don't see how you can argue that any others, it's constitutional for them to be on there. So you could have a scenario where, you know, these drugs are, some of them are descheduled in the next couple of years. And then, of course, if once the drug's descheduled, then there's nothing to stop anybody from being like, we're a mushroom church or we're an ayahuasca church or or whatever, right? Because there's no, you could have state issues, but when the when the federal government drops that, how do you really argue, you know, that there's a state's right for people practicing their religion with something the federal government says is, you know, a plant? So, yeah, but where do you guys want to kind of go, though, on the sort of religious angle? In other words, so you could say on one level, everyone using these medicines is totally protected under their First Amendment, but proving that and fighting about it and all that is a completely, you know, different game. But the drug war and the scheduling change is going to be the biggest thing. It's going to just, you know, once they're descheduled or lower scheduled, you'll have people just coming out more in public with churches around the medicines.
Yeah. Several times, I don't think a lot of people in the room know what TOAD is, so if you could tell us what is TOAD.
Sure.
And also tell us about this TOAD conference.
Yeah.
That you attended recently.
Yeah, I got my fun shirt. I was wearing my shirt from the TOAD conference. But so you have this molecule called 5-MeO-DMT. Maybe 5-MeO for short. And it's, you take DMT and you add a 5-methoxyl group on, you know, a methoxyl group on it in the fifth position. That's the difference between it and DMT. And whereas DMT, this is going to be the easiest way to explain it, and it'll help to explain kind of the difference between the two. DMT is operating at the third eye chakra, which literally is where this is blocked by illusion, and the biggest illusion is that there's separation. And ayahuasca, DMT specifically, helps you to orient and put yourself in the web of creation, in your ancestral line. How do you relate to your family, the people around you, the whole thing, right? Through sensory information, visual information, auditory information. 5-MeO-DMT, it works at the crown chakra, where all the sensory information is gone, the ego is turned off. So it's non-dual, unity, consciousness, infinity, eternity, and it's all love. And so you can literally do that, and it turns with ayahuasca, the ego, even though it's like down-regulated, the amygdala is down-regulated, so I'm just like an embryo, it's still there with the spirit, let's just call it. The higher self and the lower self are in this like dynamic dance, and you're going with 5-MeO, it's all spirit, and that's your, basically your identification is with the whole thing. So it's a substance that has been snuffed along with DMT containing plants in South America for thousands of years. Ayahuasca was actually a later invention, but in the past, you know, 20 or 30 years, this 5-MeO, so you can get 5-MeO-DMT out of one animal on the planet. It's in these other plants, but never is like the main substance. There's all these other tryptamine alkaloids in there. But, you know, creator, source, whatever, how you want to look at it, decided to put this O-methyl transferase enzyme in this one bufo that's in the Sonoran Desert that lives into part of Arizona and Mexico, where if you squeeze the glands instead of getting out bufotenine, you get out 5-MeO-DMT. And if you vaporize that, you will potentially merge with the godhead. So, or stuff like that. So, but that's just a little quick primer.
Okay,
but no, but seriously, does anybody have other questions about 5-MeO-DMT or, you know, what it is or what's, you know?
Does anyone ever have a bad trip from this?
From 5-MeO-DMT or any of these?
Any of them.
Okay, my take would be the only time you have a bad trip goes back to more like if you broke the rules, as it were, on what you have to do. Because if it's a difficult trip, then there's nothing bad. If it's difficult, if there's fear, literally, from a medicine perspective, you know, you're in medicine and you're like, wow, unicorns, mermaids, this is awesome, you know? The unicorn is like pooping out rainbows versus like, oh my God, it's so dark and, you know, scary, whatever. The fear is just a way to get more of your attention. That's all it is. It's for me, if I have any fear, I go towards it faster and right and try to breathe into it because it's not, there's no fear. It's just information and it's trying to say, I'm trying to make this more, you know, intense for you to get more of your attention. So there's no such thing in my mind as a bad trip. There's difficult trips where you uncover darker subconscious material that you need to process. But the only time people have bad trips is when they either, like I've been there, take SSRIs and then don't disclose that, and take ayahuasca and have a complete psychotic break and have serotonin syndrome for 5 days, and you know, or did the same kind of thing with Toad where they took the medicines or they were drunk before they came in or, you know, lied or were in a really bad place. People can take these medicines lots of times where they don't have, you know, they're not in the right mindset. It's a bad setting, right? Not a safe container. And they can have really bad traumatic experiences. So, but ultimately, it's not about those medicines, right? And the medicines in and of themselves are just a technology. They don't cause or deliver bad experiences. It's only people's use of them or misuse of them. In my opinion, they can ultimately deliver a bad experience. So,
and I mean, to add to that, I think as you mentioned, there is an experience amplifier. So if you experience some fear because of some trauma that's popping up, and you try to push it away, you're like, no, I don't want to think about it. That fear can multiply.
Yeah, it just amplifies until it
amplifies. Yeah, you're like, ah, that was a bad experience.
Until it breaks through. It's just like in a cell potential, right? The electricity, you know, it's like, no, you resist. And it's like, it has to get higher and higher. But at some point, it trips the switch and you, the shit comes out.
How does, when you think about, like, on a societal level, if more people were exposed to these medicines, possibly people in positions of power, like leaders, if they,
that is a great question, and that reminds me to talk a little bit about this Bufo conference I went to, where I met a guy who knows the Mexican president, like back when they were 15, or the, you know, they're same age. He said 20% of the current presidential cabinet or administration, whatever, in Mexico has done some kind of psychedelic medicine. So, Graham Hancock, you know. He said, make a joke, and it's on the internet, you know, like a meme that everyone should have to drink ayahuasca 10 times before they serve in public office. And so, I love that sort of meme and idea. And I don't believe any of these things are, like I said, magic bullets. But that would be sort of a great thing. And it's just saying, if the political process is just so hard, man. The people that get in there and go for it, they're nuts. You know what I mean? You gotta be nuts to do it. So it's I don't just know those, you know, getting those people to drink ayahuasca. But hey, at the same time, you know, the veteran angle coming into it. I have friends that lobby in D.C. and, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, right? She could be the next vice presidential candidate on the Democratic side, and her office knows about ayahuasca. So that, you know, people, they're hearing and knowing about it. I'm definitely involved with people that are trying to take like special forces, and I've done some of this myself, you know, and SEALs and guys like that, people like that, to these medicines, to instead of having Chris Kyle, American Sniper, you have, hey, badass American over here, but, you know, healed the trauma and the addictions and is also, you know, not trying to promote violence as a tool to solve our problems. And that's really starting to happen. So does that kind of...
So 5-MeO-DMT found in the glands of a toad? Or
yes, one particular species has this, medicine in there.
So is it like on the skin or is it just like a gland?
Okay, yeah, so, you know, since I don't want to go to the slides and all that crap, yeah. Right? But it has these parotid glands on its back,
yeah.
Two big ones, and then it has... one on it, like it has it on its arms, and
yeah.
Then two little ones on its back, his legs. So you milk that, you squeeze it, and people collect it. Let's say they put it in an aquarium, right, and it squirts on there, and then it dries, and then they scrape it. And 15% of that material,
yeah.
On average, let's say, is 5-MeO-DMT. And then you would vaporize that and inhale that, where you can. That medicine can be taken nasally, vaporized, sublingually, rectally.
Because this is one episode of The Simpsons where Homer Simpson licks a toad.
Yes, there's all sorts of, like, right? You know, pop culture. Well, okay, so you can. Okay, so you can lick a toad.
You can or you can't?
You can. Now, you shouldn't, but you can. Because if you think about it, that's what the dogs are doing in one way when they're biting it, right? They're biting the toad, squeezing that gland, and the stuff is shooting into their mouth on their mucous membranes, so they're starting to get it sublingual, right? And any kind of mucous membrane, your eyes, any place where it would absorb in, and that's how they're getting the medicine in. Now, there's enough medicine for, like, five people out of one squirt to have a full experience, so you can see why, even though it's not as effective, right, licking the toad, getting it... biting the toad, I'm not recommending anybody do that, but you would get that medicine in your mouth. And you so, you know, the dogs that they've shown that have bitten the Sonora Desert toad, it's like they don't have the bufotenine poisoning, which is the salivating and the turning purple. They have the 5-MeO, and they just, yeah, they lay there for 20 minutes, their eyes closed, and then, you know, come back out of it and whatever, you know. It's like, I don't know, you know, like, dude, dog is just God spelled backwards, man. you know, whatever, you know, happens with a dog. Yeah. But yeah, but there was a mural in Austin. They've changed it. Someone said it on down at 6th Street, like Nueces and 6th, on the side of the building, and said a toad. It actually had written as a frog, but it was a Sonora Desert toad with a person's licking it, and it said, you know, a frog a day keeps the doctor away. So. Yeah, I went to this Congress in Mexico, World Bufo Alvarius Conference, the first time anyone had ever had a conference about it, 300 people in Mexico City, and we went and had, you know, practitioners and PhDs and MDs and people with personal experience for 3 days talk about this medicine and show movies and a lot of reintegration. The second half of those 3 days, they did all a reintegration track, so you could go and do sound healing and meditation and all these other techniques, yoga, you know, while you're even in the conference. And then most people stayed on a couple extra days and went out to the pyramids. And so Teotihuacan is legal in Mexico, so we went out to the pyramids, Teotihuacan, the pyramid of the sun and the moon, smoked toad, and it was fucking pretty amazing. And it was funny because it's not illegal, but down there they don't want you to do any ceremonies where you're not paying them. So, right, so they're not like, you have drugs. You're like, are you ceremonializing over there? Are you, you know, you guys. So we were having to, like, watch out because, you know, didn't want to be excessive, you know, doing stuff without throwing them some money. But, yeah.
Don't you find it fascinating that there's a toad and there's a pineal gland of this toad that manufactures a chemical that lets you merge with the godhead?
Dude,
insane. A skeptic would say it's just like making your brain go through this whatever and then you're interpreting it as an experience that every human wants or something like that.
Yeah, well, it's super interesting, right? Because from my perspective, you know, Source likes to hide things in plain sight where lazy, disinterested people won't look. But it's always in plain sight, right? So, yeah, but it's super crazy when you think about this toad lives in the ground, okay, in the Sonoran Desert, 9 months out of the year, except when it comes out when the summer monsoon rains hit. So literally, here's the sound. Tap, tap, tap. Here's enough rain hitting, right? Then it comes out. And so you think of it's Bufa alvarius. That word alvarius means from the womb. It lives in the ground for 9 months. You know, then it comes out, and it comes out in the rains, and it eats, and it reproduces, and it does everything. And yeah, it's, you know, here's a really interesting little tidbit for you guys, UT, and my son's at UT, and my daughter's at A&M, so she wanted me to say some stuff, but I won't say anything. So. But the guy who wrote this book on Bufo is a University of Texas professor, and back in 72, and they, like, analyzed the skins of 60 different Bufo and all these different species, and that's the first place, like in real public disclosure, where he mentions this. He doesn't even call it 5-MeO-DMT because he calls it kind of by a different chemical name of the same stuff, right? You can call things by different names. And yeah, he points that out in just multiple places. Says, hey, Bufa alvarius is very special because it contains this, you know, O-methyl transferase enzyme that allows this stuff to be made. I mean, it's mind-blowing. It's insane. It's crazy. It, you know, makes no sense. But yeah, people take this medicine, and then what's really attractive to me about this particular medicine is that you can have a transpersonal experience of whatever energy source, you know, whatever those things, they're all just terms that we're using to try to describe something that's beyond that. You get a transpersonal experience of that, which means it's not mediated by anybody else. No one's telling you, you have to believe this. And, you know, ayahuasca is a little bit more like, hey, here's kind of how we do our stuff. And, you know, here's kind of how our worldview or the songs we sing. This is like, you experience what that means to you, and there's no one else involved. And then you come back, you know, so you have a bigger, you expand your identity to a bigger state or, you know, however you want to look at it. And you know, you bring that back yourself, and no one else can tell you what that is. And so I think it's people who, you know, I know lots of people, I'm not trying to like sell this as this thing, but let's say they have a very reductionist or materialist approach to things. This can help to give them a different perspective on it, but it has meaning for them. It's not mediated by any kind of organized religion or anything like that. And I think that's what's really amazing, is that you can take this stuff yourself and, you know, figure out the bigger mysteries without anybody else's, you know, information, right? You know, just the taking part, you need that support potentially, but anyway, so. What other questions do you guys have?
I still have one. So you kind of addressed this already, but I wanted to get it more directly. Since you work specifically with troops, veterans who have very specific things, know, traumatic experiences to work through, but you also kind of recommended more broadly to people. Would you make a really broad statement that everyone, if they approached it properly, would benefit from this?
Everyone who, there's definitely contraindications, right? I mean, it's schizophrenia, personality disorder, you know, psychoses. You know, you don't want people with real serious medical issues taking these things. But beyond that, someone who's called to the medicine, which just means that you have a legitimate reason for yourself that you want to go and do this work and do something with it, getting the right, you know, practitioner or all the things you need to have a successful experience, however that's going to go, doing it yourself, whatever, is that you have that right intention, yeah, people can totally benefit. But, I mean, ultimately, I think it'll be one of those things more that not everyone has to do it, but the benefits of people doing it will spread out further. Like, you know, someone asked me at ayahuasca, oh, what do your dogs think about when you do ayahuasca, or your animals, whatever, your pets, you know? And I was like, well, they think that I'm less of an asshole. You know, I act as less of an asshole towards them. So, you know, it's what you get out of it should really be practical, I guess. So.
Yeah, I guess, and to add to that, so Michael Tollan has this book on
Can I ask? Can I jump? Who else has read this? The Michael Pollan book so far, or has it, like, you know, to read? Michael Pollan. He's the foremost food author probably on the planet. Omnivore's Dilemma, In Defense of Food, Cooked, and then a book previously called Botany of Desire. So he's a New York Times bestselling author who wrote this book about psychedelics called How to Change Your Mind. And he's been on now Stephen Colbert, NPR, Fresh Air. You know, he's hit the major kind of outlets. And so, yeah, so just let people know about this book.
Again, he mentions that the researchers think that, so the mind can either be too structured and obsessive or too non-structured or in between that spectrum and different people. And the psychedelics seem to help everybody who is biased towards too much structure, like addictions or compulsive or obsessions. Those are like too much structure, and even the normal people, I guess, are too structured. But anybody who is on the other side of the spectrum, like kids of they'll be, I guess, harmed by having this experience. So.
Yeah, and you kind of have these two sides of it where you have this sort of trauma and healing side, and then you have the kind of personal growth side, and these two things will work together. This is, let's say, veterans or anyone who's had any kind of trauma. And over here you have the microdosing, Silicon Valley, Burning Man, 4-hour work week, Paleo FX, like human potential stuff. I met a guy down in Mexico. He has a company, 50 people. It's a company that they use software to make sure that their employees are happy or happier, you know, make them support their happiness. And they have the metrics, you know what I mean? And they have the software and they have the vision and all that stuff to do it. And so I'm like, you know, these are the kind of, that's how, you know, business will spend money on this, right? You know, over here you're like, man, come on, help the veterans. Hey, it'll save you money. You can spend, you know, a couple hundred bucks, you know, $1,000 on an ayahuasca voucher instead of giving them all these meds. But over here, you know, this is the part that will kind of drive it for the culture is people who are, hey, I don't really have trauma. My life's, you know, generally fine, whatever, but I want to be more efficient. I want to be more creative. I want to be more this and that. And, you know, and this part of it here too will help subsidize this sort of healing part over there. So.
Do you feel like if people are doing it for that, though, they're doing it for the wrong reason? I mean, it's not like all these tech companies are so great in the end. You know,
yeah, that's a totally right. That's a totally great question, and kind of an irony, right? It's like we're shifting on cannabis and. You know, I tell people, here's a headline from the future. 2026 World Cup in the U.S., Mexico, Canada. The Weed World Cup. It's definitely going to be legal by then. FIFA can only spend so much money, get so much money from selling beer before the fans start to fight with each other. You know, right? So they're going to be, weed's going to be everywhere in that World Cup. So, yeah, I'm not saying like exactly because they're going to do that, like, that's good. I mean, I've never been to Burning Man, but look at Burning Man. It's, like, sold out. It's totally corporate. It's, like, a bunch of, you know, tech people from the Bay Area going out in their super massive stuff. It used to be all, like, trade economy. And anyway, so, yeah, I'm not making any judgments, like, right on the good or bad of that. I'm just more like that's kind of what's going to happen. And, yeah, and then, Aubrey Marcus here in town, right, on it. And that whole kind of Joe Rogan angle. So, is it going to be scary if someone walks into Google and they're like, here's your microdose, welcome to Google, here's your microdose kit, you know? You expected to track your results, you know? But I mean, we're getting to the edge with all these changes in our social structures and, you know, I was watching some stuff right about, you know, quantum computing and saying we have, like, really simulations of computer. You know, we have proto computers that are doing 30 qubits, and they said that at 300 you can map every atom in the universe. And I was like, that's not, you know, that doesn't seem too far away when you can create a simulation, at least at the atomic atom level, right, of everything in the universe. That's a lot. So, gonna be interesting times. And I just want to argue for, hey, if we're gonna get into all these alternative technologies, right, altered states of consciousness, we should master the archaic ones before we try to step into the holodeck and try to say, let's go on a couple year journey to you know, the stars next door. We need to tap back into these things that people have been using for thousands of years to help people, you know, align their conscious and subconscious or get all their woo-woos lined up, you know, whatever it is. Well, I think that's probably a good place to come to a close then. Wow.
Thank you guys.
Yep, that was a lot of fun. Yeah. So, yeah, and I'll definitely, you know.